Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to speak here at the KITP. I'm going to be talking about some work together with Vijay Balasubramanian, David Bernstein, Aitor Lukowitz, Alex Miller, and Charles Rabideau, and some ongoing work with a subset of these people. We think of black holes as some kind of coarse-grained description of the black hole geometry as being some kind of coarse-grained description of a large class of underlying microstates. So roughly the picture is that the classical part of the black hole or the black hole geometry basically just describes some universal classical physics, and then there's some microscopic physics which takes over where the sort of classical geometry breaks down. And indeed, more recently the discussions have pointed to the fact that gravity in itself is sort of describes in some sense a coarse-grained description of a certain class of ultraviolet systems. And so in this talk we want to understand this perspective on black holes as being coarse-grained descriptions of microstates, but from a somewhat phase space point of view on the gravity side. So in other words, we want to think about the gravitational phase space as emerging from coarse graining of an underlying microscopic phase space, but we want to understand how the sort of gravitational modes emerge from such a coarse graining. And we'll be working in a very specific example. So the black holes we are going to be interested in are half BPS or supersymmetric black holes in type 2b supergravity, which are dual to half BPS states in the Super-Yang-Mills theory. So of course, ADS-CFT gives us a lot of power, a lot of control in this setting, and the aim will be to understand in this very controlled setting how coarse graining on the CFT side gives rise to nice gravitational modes on the gravity side. Okay, that's the rough idea. All right. So before going on, I'll start with a sort of brief review of the ADS-CFT correspondence in this half BPS sector. Okay. So let's begin by talking about the half BPS states in n equals 4 super Yang Mills. So in the half BPS sector, this theory reduces drastically, and you can basically sort of reduce this the super Yang Mills theory to a matrix model with the following action. So X here is an n by n matrix, and you can think of that as being one of the scalar combinations inside the six scalars of n equals 4 super Yang Mills theory. Okay, so it's essentially in the super Yang Mills theory, this is an S wave on the, so you put the super Yang Mills theory on a three sphere, and you look at the S wave that of one of the six scalars, and that's this X. So it's essentially just a matrix, and it depends on time. So the theory basically reduces to a matrix quantum mechanics system. All right. So you can actually go further with this because there's only one matrix. You can, in fact, there's also a gauge field sitting in here whose equation of motion sets the, basically gets rid of the, it imposes the Gauss law, if you like. It imposes gauge invariance. And that allows you to reduce this action or this Lagrangian down to the eigenvalues of the matrix X. Okay, so it becomes even simpler. You have n, the matrix has n eigenvalues, and each of them are in the harmonic oscillator potential. Okay, so you just have n, this is a theory of n harmonic oscillators, but the one subtlety in this discussion is that when you go from x to lambda, there is a change in the path integral. You pick out a measure. The measure is the famous van der Waals determinant. In fact, you pick up a square of this determinant. So the way to deal with that change of measure is that you absorb this piece inside the wave function of your harmonic oscillators. And what that does is it basically makes these oscillators fermionic. Okay, they anti-commute because you've absorbed this measure inside the wave function.
So question. Yeah. The first line, the gauge field is not dynamical?
No, it's dynamical.
It is dynamical.
Yeah. But you,
does it have a kinetic term?
No, it does not. This is all. It's dynamical in the sense that it's integrated over in the path integral. So when you do that integral, it gauge fixes all the other degrees of freedom except for the eigenvalues. That's all. That's its only job. Yeah. Very good. So the model reduces to n harmonic oscillators, but they're fermionic. Okay, so how do you build the Hilbert space of the system? It's very simple. Because the potential is that of a harmonic oscillator, you start with the energy levels of a harmonic oscillator, and you have n of them, so you basically fill up the first n of them, okay? Because they're fermionic. Right? This picture is supposed to indicate the ground state. The ground state is just fill up the first capital N energy levels of the harmonic oscillator, where this N is the SUN of the Yang-Mills theory. Okay? And if you want to excite, you want to construct excited states in this language, it's also very simple. You excite some of these fermions about the ground state. Okay? So excited states are also very simple. It turns out that there is a Young diagram description for excited states. Here, basically what you do is you ask how many energy levels is the topmost fermion excited by. So say in this case you have the topmost fermion is excited by two energy levels, and then the next one is excited. So let me do a simpler case. Let's say I excite this one. The next one is excited by two more, and so on. That allows you to write down a Young diagram. Okay. For example, say I drew a Young diagram like this. The number of boxes in the topmost row tells you how many energy levels the first fermion is excited by. So if I have three of them, I would excite the topmost fermion by three energy levels, and then the next one by two, and so on. Okay. That's sort of, if you like, this is an easy way to keep track of energy eigenstates in this model by drawing Young diagrams. But that's not going to be super important for my purpose, so I'm not going too much into the details of that. But the basic picture is that you can build excited states by starting with the ground state and exciting fermions as much as you like. All right, but there's a more convenient way to describe the Hilbert space in this model, which is what we will talk about next. So what you do is you introduce second quantized fermion creation and annihilation operators. Okay, so what these psi's or psi daggers are, they create, a psi dagger creates one fermion in the energy level, in the nth energy level of the harmonic oscillator. Okay, that's the definition of psi. And they satisfy this the usual algebra of creation annihilation operators, except these are anti-commutators because the objects that you're creating are fermions. Okay? And now in terms of these second quantized fermion creation annihilation operators, we will define what I'll call the Wigner density, or sometimes I'll usually just refer to this as the phase space density, U, which is defined as follows. So this expression is probably familiar to many of you. It looks like the usual Wigner density, except now I've written it in terms of these operators. So if you look at the one-point function of this operator in some state, then it gives you the roughly the probability distribution for fermions or for that particular region of phase space being occupied. Okay, so it's not a probability distribution, it's a quasi-probability distribution, but in a sufficiently classical state, the one-point function of U will be a nice probability distribution, and it will tell you the probability for occupation of that region of phase space. So I haven't completely defined this object yet. What the psi hat operator is the following. Okay, so the psi n's are, of course, the operators, the second quantized fermion creation operators. These guys create fermions in the nth. This guy creates or annihilates a fermion in the nth energy eigenstate. Fn is the wave function for the harmonic oscillator wave function of the nth harmonic oscillator wave function. And so psi hat of q roughly creates or annihilates a fermion at q, at the position q. Okay? And u hat is defined in terms of psi. Very good. So roughly the picture for U is that if I look at the phase space of the harmonic oscillator, and if I look at the nth energy eigenvalue or the wave function corresponding to the phase space density corresponding to the nth energy eigenvalue, then it's going to be peaked around some circle. Okay? Where it's peaked is basically around the energy p squared plus over q squared over 2 is the energy. Okay, so if I'm looking at the energy eigenstate corresponding to E, then its wave function will be sort of somewhat peaked in a ring in phase space around that energy with the thickness h bar. All right, so with that in mind, now we can go back to our ground state. Remember, the ground state had the first n energy levels occupied. So what's going to happen for the ground state is that the first n of the, so in the phase space, you sort of have the first n rings filled up or occupied. And so if you compute the phase space density in the ground state of this model, that basically looks like a disk which has the first n of these rings filled up. Okay. And then essentially small excitations around this state correspond to sort of small fluctuations of the shape of this disk or the boundary of this disk.
Is that field U, is it related to the collective field of Das and Shaviki in some way? Or?
Das and Shaviki. Right, I mean, it does sound, it's like a bilocal field. Maybe you can, so what's going to happen in, later in the story is that this U is going to end up being related to the, in from an ADS CFT perspective, this U is exactly the thing gets which gets related to the bulk geometry or the bulk metric. This was the sort of old story of Lin, Lunin, and Malusina, right? So in some sense, yes, this U is like some collective field which gets geometrized in the bulk. But I'm not sure whether there's like a Das-Chivikhi type construction which shows that. But probably. Yeah. All right, very good. So as I was saying, excitations or small excitations around the vacuum can be represented as sort of shape deformations of this this droplet, if you like. And you can also talk about other kinds of excitations, which we will. That will be the main focus of the talk. But before that, let me very quickly review what happens on the gravity side. So this was sort of a very lightning introduction of the CFT side of the story. Now on the gravity side. So on the gravity side, of course, we have type 2 supergravity. There's a class of solutions that one can write down in supergravity, which has the same set of symmetries and supersymmetry, which is the following. So this was done by Lin, Lunin, and Malusena, which I will just call LLM. So that's the metric. What you can also write down the corresponding four-form gauge, the solution for the four-form gauge field, and so on. I'm not going to write that down because it's not that important. So let's take a moment to stare at the metric. First of all, there are two spheres sitting around here. There is omega 3 and omega 3 tilde. But other than these two, three spheres and time, the main action in this geometry is sort of happening in these three coordinates. There is a y coordinate, which is always positive. And x, these x's, they live in R2. So there are two of these, x1 and x2. There's no constraint on these guys. They just live in the two-dimensional plane. Okay. All of these functions that you're seeing here, like, for example, h and v and g and so on, all of these functions can be written in terms of one function, which let me call z. And the z only depends on these three coordinates. All right? So for that reason, most of the action is happening in these three coordinates over here. All right, and this furthermore, for this metric to satisfy the equations of motion appropriate with the appropriate matter fields and so on, the z satisfies a very simple second order differential equation, which is the following. OK, so it satisfies this Laplace-type equation. Very good. And so, of course, we know how to solve this differential equation. So z can be easily solve for using this differential equation, except because this field y, this coordinate y is always greater than 0, we need to impose some boundary condition on z at y equals 0. Okay? So at y equals 0, so roughly the picture is that you have this x1, x2 plane, which I'll often refer to as the LLM plane, and then there's y, which is this other coordinate, this positive coordinate. And then you can solve for this function and consequently the entire metric in all of this region up here, provided you specify some boundary condition at y equals 0. Okay, the boundary condition, let's call the boundary condition z0 of x1 and x2. Okay, so this boundary condition is only a function of these two coordinates, x1 and x2, or it's only a function of the LLM plane. Okay, so given these boundary conditions, you can pretty easily solve for the metric, and in particular for this z field everywhere. Now, there's a curious thing which happens here, which is that for this metric, so you can, of course, you can solve for z and plug it in here and get the metric out of there. But for that metric to be regular everywhere, it turns out that this boundary condition is not allowed to be anything you want, but it can only take on two values. Okay. So it turns out that this boundary condition can only take on the value plus half or minus half. Okay. So essentially, the picture is that there's some region on this LLM plane where maybe z naught, this boundary condition can be plus half, which I'm denoting here with the shaded region, and it's minus half, let's say, everywhere else. And then in that situation, you can construct a regular geometry. The reason for this is that in regions where this boundary condition is plus half, one of these three spheres shrinks smoothly at the LLM plane. When it's minus half, the other three sphere is shrinking smoothly. But if the boundary condition is not either plus or minus half, then you end up having a singularity, a conical singularity at this plane, at this boundary. Okay. All right. So hopefully this sort of thing should remind you of the phase space density discussion that we were we had in the half PPS sector of n equals 4. And indeed, the correspondence between this class of geometries on the gravity side and the half VPS states on the CFT side, the correspondence that was proposed by these folks was that we should identify the phase space density. Let me use Q and P here. We should first of all identify the phase space we should identify the phase space on the CFT side with this two-dimensional plane, the LLM plane, on the gravity side. The phase space density should be identified with half minus z naught. Remember that this phase space density, at least in the classical limit, essentially becomes like a droplet in the regions of the phase space which are occupied by fermions, you get sort of a probability density of 1, or the phase space density becomes 1, and it's 0 outside. So it exactly has the right features to be a good boundary or to give a good boundary condition in gravity. The other thing all right, so that was the duality, or that was the correspondence that was proposed in this paper between these class of geometries in supergravity and half PPS states in the Super-Yang-Mills theory. Okay, so that was a brief review of the correspondence between the two sides. the half VPS, half VPS sector of ADS CFT. Okay, so. Well, that was the sort of proposal that was made in this paper. You know, one way to say why this is reasonable is that when you say that P and Q are conjugate, you mean that they form some phase space, right? There is a symplectic form on this space. This is a symplectic manifold. On the gravity side, what you can do is you can just study this class of geometries, and you can calculate the symplectic form that gravity gives you. It turns out that that agrees with the symplectic form that you get on here. So in other words, this symplectic form can be recovered from the symplectic form of gravity for these class of geometries. So that's maybe one way why you think that this is reasonable.
So why is like the holographic direction, right?
Well, y is not exactly the holographic direction because this picture is close to y equals 0. Yeah. So when y becomes large, though, it's related to the holographic direction.
Okay. What is the boundary of ADS? Because you have x1.
Right. So the boundary of ADS lives at. So what you do is you can define a radial coordinate. And then you combine, so you define y squared plus r squared. That's roughly at asymptotic infinity, the radial direction and asymptotic ADS. Yeah. Sure. Any other questions?
So there was no like specific reason why you chose y to be like to impose your boundary condition at y equals 0. Like, could I, in principle, impose the boundary condition at either x1 or x2 equal to 0, and would the other two still form, like, a phase space?
Yeah, except x1 and x2 are, they're not necessarily positive. X1 and x2 they live in R, yeah, I should have written this explicitly. This lives in R2. So it's not very natural to impose boundary conditions at the origin. Yeah. Okay, so what we want to do with these geometries or these states is we want to study a class of highly excited black hole like states in these geometries. So these are called superstars. And these were studied in some detail in several papers by Balasubramanian, De Boer, Jezula, Simon, Maralf, Cech, and so on. Lots of people have studied these geometries in the past. So just to say a few words about what these geometries should look like, they basically correspond to, they are basically geometries in this class of LLM geometries, where you specify the boundary condition on the LLM plane to be, so here's one example of a superstar geometry. You consider the boundary condition on the LLM plane to be a large number of concentric black and white circles. Okay, so I've just drawn 3 here, but imagine that there is an order n, or a very, very large number of these black and white circles, each with a tiny, tiny thickness. Okay. So one issue that you might see immediately with these kind of boundary conditions is that they don't have a nice classical limit. Okay. So if the thickness of this ring is order h bar, and there are n of them, when you send n to infinity and h bar to 0, there is no nice classical limit that this phase space density takes, so it's hard to translate these into smooth gravitational geometries. Okay, so one thing that you might do is you might say, well, let me coarse grain this boundary condition a little bit, in particular to scales bigger than the size of these rings. If you do that, then what you're going to end up with is some kind of disk which has gray boundary conditions. In other words, the phase space density is not 0 or 1, but it just sort of, it's uniform, but it's half, let's say. Okay? You can do that, but the problem with that sort of, the problem with that sort of boundary condition is recall from this discussion here that for the metric to be regular, you really need the phase space density or the boundary condition at the LLM plane to be either plus or minus half. Okay, if it's not, then you get a geometry which is not regular at the LLM plane, and indeed it has a singularity. And that geometry, nevertheless, which you can construct, was called the superstar by Myers and Taffyard. Okay, and so several people, which I mentioned in this list of papers that were written, sort of explained how one can think of these superstar geometries, which are singular in gravity, being nevertheless regular on the quantum mechanics side. They correspond to a large class of microstates, which are perfectly well-defined in quantum mechanics. But when you translate them to gravity, they look like singular geometries. OK, very good. So what we want to do with these geometries is we want to revisit this coarse graining description from the perspective of the phase space of gravity. OK? In other words, we want to study the phase space of excitations around these superstar black holes. Okay, so what do I mean by that? So I have my LLM plane. As I just described to you, I can take one of those boundary conditions and I can coarse grain over it to get sort of gray boundary condition in some disk. Okay, so that right there is sort of a gray disk. And what we are going to do is we are going to consider fluctuations of this geometry, which correspond to little sort of grayscale fluctuations. Right. So the idea is to study sort of fluctuations of this geometry, which correspond to little fluctuations of this grayscale density on the LLM plane. Okay. So the disk is basically gray. It has density half, but you can imagine sort of constructing a small fluctuation of this density. Which is nevertheless a smoothly varying small grayscale fluctuation on the LLM plane. All right. So that's essentially the mode, if you like, on the gravity side, whose phase space we want to study. Okay. We want to understand the phase space structure for this type of mode. One way to think about that, if you're uncomfortable with considering these kind of boundary conditions at the LLM plane where this geometry becomes singular, we can equivalently think about that in the following way. Imagine that you have some nice microstate, you put a microstate which corresponds to one of these superstar geometries, and you put a stretched horizon at some scale y, let me call that y naught, away from this plane where the geometry would become singular, And you read off the density of this function z, if you like, at this stretched horizon. So it's a fact that if you try to solve this differential equation, then evolution in this y direction is like coarse graining, okay? Because you, in solving this differential equation, you convolve the boundary condition with a particular kernel, and that looks like coarse graining. So if you try to read off what the phase space density looks like at this cutoff surface, it's going to look like a gray disk. Okay, it's going to look like a coarse grained version of the density. So you might imagine this calculation is corresponding to sort of putting a stretched horizon and considering small fluctuations of the grayscale density at the stretched horizon, if that is helpful. Very good. All right, so now how do we calculate how do we study the phase space structure of this mode in gravity? Well, what you do is you study the symplectic form of gravity for fluctuations corresponding to these type of fluctuations. Okay, so the symplectic form for 2B supergravity, especially in these class of geometries, was studied by Maus and Richkov a while ago. But they studied the symplectic form around regular geometries, which correspond to nice regular boundary conditions on the LLM plane. But here we are doing something different, which is that we are studying it around the superstar for these type of grayscale fluctuations. Okay, well, roughly the symplectic form, I'm not going to give you the full expression, it's kind of complicated, but very roughly, the symplectic form looks like following. So the symplectic form is basically, you know, it's roughly dq dp. Right, the analog of what you would write down in quantum mechanics. So here we have the metric on a Cauchy slice in the bulk geometry, and its conjugate momentum is the extrinsic curvature. I'm not writing out the detailed expression here. This is very schematic. And then there is the four-form gauge field and its corresponding field strength, or electric field, if you like, which appears as its momentum. Okay, so. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. So the way we regulated that calculation is we put that stretched horizon in. So we put a cutoff slightly above the LLM plane, and then you evaluate your symplectic form only outside the stretched horizon.
And the cutoff is what kind of cutoff? It's just that you assume you've got kind of, you treat it as having a fixed induced metric on the cutoff surface.
Yes. Exactly. A better way of saying that is you fix this function u. Good. That's equivalent to fixing the metric, because u enters the metric. So you fix u, okay. That fixes the metric.
And you say if you compute the symplectic form of the cutoff, yeah. It's well defined.
Yeah, and then you take this and you cut off to zero.
And you get this.
I haven't told you what I get. This is just the full expression for gravity. On any Cauchy surface, but yeah, you're exactly right. You do this calculation with this symplectic form, and I'm going to tell you in a moment what I get.
But your statement is that this is actually finite.
It is finite. That's right. It's finite in the limit that you send the cutoff to zero.
And it's also conserved in the superstar geometry because you're static. So.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. I mean, the superstars themselves, right, are some of running in some manifold of the phase. No, there's a phase space. Non-trivial phase space on the superstar geometry,
yes.
Even though they're all static.
Yes.
Okay. Good.
So this is the calculation you're supposed to do. The only thing I have to tell you now is what are delta G and so on. Basically, G, A, K, and so on are given by this ansatz. Inside this ansatz, there is this boundary condition Z naught, or the density. And the deltas here just mean change that boundary condition from the original grayscale boundary condition to this small sort of grayscale fluctuation. Okay, that's delta. That's what I mean by delta. So that's going to give you a symplectic form, the induced symplectic form on these type of grayscale fluctuations. Okay, and when you do that with this cutoff and so on that we just talked about, you get the following result. All right, so first of all, this integral is only inside this grayscale region. Let me denote it like that. It's only inside of here. Delta U is this grayscale fluctuation that I just, I'm just denoting x with these two coordinates, q and p, with x over here. Delta U is this grayscale fluctuation that we discussed. I now have to tell you what lambda and lambda tilde are. So lambda and lambda tilde are holonomies. So in this geometry, you can roughly think about them in the following way. There's this, the LLM plane sits at y equals 0. And at y equals, so as y goes to infinity, you sort of approach the asymptotic boundary. Okay. What lambda and lambda tilde are basically holonomies for the four-form gauge field from the asymptotic boundary, or from y equals infinity, down to the cutoff surface close to the LLM plane. Okay, so let me just write that out. So there are two of them because this guy is a four-form gauge field. So just integrating from along the y direction is not enough. You have to integrate in three other dimensions or directions. So one is integrated on one of these three. There are three spheres floating around in that geometry. So you integrate. If you integrate around one of the three spheres, you get what I call lambda. And you integrate around the other three sphere, you get lambda twiddle. Okay. So that gives you these two holonomies. For the four-form gauge field, which go from the asymptotic infinity down to the cutoff surface. Okay, and it's these two holonomies which enter the symplectic form as being, if you like, canonically conjugate to this grayscale fluctuation. All right, so one comment about this result is that if you are working in a microstate, or better to say, if you are working in a geometry where there was no, where the boundary conditions at the LLM plane were perfectly regular, then these guys would just entirely get fixed. The lambdas and the lambda twiddles would get fixed in terms of delta u. One way to think about that is that in any regular geometry, the LLM boundary is not a boundary. The geometry sort of smoothly caps off as you approach the LLM plane, okay? But that's not the situation we are here in the superstar geometry. In the superstar, the LLM boundary sort of acts like a real boundary in some sense, because there's if you like, you put a stretched horizon there, or there's a singularity sitting down there. And so these holonomies, which would otherwise have been pure gauge modes in any given microstate geometry, they don't decouple from the symplectic form, and indeed they appear as being conjugate to this sort of grayscale fluctuations. So I think of this situation as being analogous somewhat to the situation in gauge theories, where if you calculate the symplectic form of a gauge theory on a subregion than what you would have thought of as pure gauge modes previously end up being physical on the boundary or the cut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the gauge field, and therefore you sort of said that gauge invariance is broken on the cutoff surface. Is this an artifact of that?
Yeah.
I might imagine that there's another notion of cutoff where I, in fact, with the cutoff, preserve gauge invariance on the cutoff surface. And if I could do that and compute a symplectic form and take some limit, it's not immediately obvious to me that you'd have the same.
Well, I mean, we tried doing that. We tried to find boundary conditions where this sort of mode does not appear in the symplectic form, and we weren't successful in doing that. Part of the reason is because the way this mode in any regular geometry, the way this mode gets fixed is by requiring regularity.
Right.
You require that the geometry be regular as you approach the LLM plane. That you don't have that kind of boundary condition in the superstar geometry. Well, it's.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm not sure. Maybe there is some combination of these things that you can fix to completely get rid of this lambda mode. But our thinking was that at least in the way that we did the calculation with these boundary conditions, this particular mode ends up in the symplectic form of gravity, and then maybe we should go looking for an explanation for this mode in the CFT. And that's what I'm going to do in the rest of the talk. But the questions you're asking are also excellent and deserve further thought. All right, so the rest of the talk, we are going to try and understand try to give some explanation for the emergence of this kind of would-be pure gauge mode from the CFT perspective. All right, great. So if I want to come up with some explanation for this mode in the CFT, well, I have to compute some type of symplectic form in the CFT. So how do I get a symplectic form from matrix quantum mechanics? So one way to do that is to use the method of coadjoint orbits and so on, but simply put, what one can do is the following. So you imagine constructing states in the CFT, which are sort of coherent states, or they are coherent excitations around some background state. Okay, the background state that we are going to pick is going to be some microscopic state corresponding to this sort of gray phase space density. You can, for example, imagine picking a microscopic state which has this type of phase space density. Okay. So that background state, I'm going to just denote by U0. U0 again is a background state which has the phase space density corresponding to that picture over there. Okay, and on top of that state, you build some coherent excitations, or you build a coherent state around it. So recall that this operator U hat, which I have an expression for over here, u hat is this operator in the quantum mechanics, and pi here is some function. It's sort of the coefficient of this operator in the coherent state, and let's just consider these type of coherent states. So of course I can sort of consider a linearized version of this if you like. All right. Now in terms of these, what these sort of states are, you can think of them as sort of corresponding to deformations of this background phase space density. Okay. In particular, for example, you can ask under this deformation, how does the one-point function of u change, or how does the, if you like, how does the, what is the grayscale fluctuation corresponding to these type of coherent excitations? And what you find is the following. So the change in the one-point function, or the change in the grayscale density, is given by the Poisson bracket of this function delta pi with the background grayscale density u naught. And by Poisson bracket, I just mean the quantum mechanics Poisson bracket. Okay, so it's the usual thing that we are familiar with. Very good. So now you see what this delta pi is. You can essentially think of this delta pi as parametrizing the change in the grayscale density. Okay, whatever grayscale density you want to construct, you basically solve this equation here to sort of invert for delta pi in terms of delta u. Okay. Very good. Now in this language, we can construct the symplectic form. Okay, the symplectic form is going to be sort of in this language, the Berry curvature. Okay? You can sort of take these expressions, plug it in, and obtain the following expression for the symplectic form. So just to parse this expression a little bit, the symplectic form takes in sort of two variations, which I'm calling delta 1u and delta 2u, and it spits out a number. That's this here, this thing here. The only thing I have to tell you is how delta 1u and delta 1 pi are related, and they are related by this expression. Okay. So given a delta 1u, you can calculate what the delta pi is from this formula, plug it in, and that tells you the symplectic form for these fluctuations. All right, very good. Now, in the last remaining 3 minutes or so, I'm going to try to explain where you get those, where you get these gravitational modes from in the CFT. So imagine zooming in. Imagine zooming into some region of this picture here, the phase space, the background phase space density here. So we sort of imagine zooming in into some region of that phase space density. Okay. So if you zoom in, to a small enough region, What you have is, let's imagine that you have some small number of rings like this. Now you can consider two types of fluctuations around these type of configurations. Okay, I'm going to call these A and B. All right, so what we have here is we are considering a sort of zoomed in region of that phase space density, and we are imagining two sort of fluctuations of this microscopic phase space density. Okay, one is where you take each of these individual rings and you fatten them, in the way that's drawn. I'm calling this mode delta A. And then there's another also slowly varying configuration. By the way, these are both sort of slowly varying configurations because the amount by which you sort of fatten these rings depends sort of smoothly on where you are in the. Anyway, so this the other mode is where you sort of locally translate each of these rings. Okay. Now, you know. Pictorially, you can imagine what happens to the phase space density when you coarse grain over these kind of fluctuations, right? So when you coarse grain over this type of fluctuation, what's going to happen is because these rings are sort of locally fattened, the coarse grain phase space density will change, okay? In fact, you can argue for yourself that this delta A is essentially exactly the grayscale fluctuation that we were considering previously, okay? This mode here gives you a sort of coarse grain, upon coarse graining gives you a grayscale fluctuation of your phase space density. On the other hand, this mode, although it's a slowly varying mode, does not appear in the coarse grain phase space density. Why? Because these are sort of local translations. So if you coarse grain over this particular mode of the microscopic fluctuation, then in the phase space density, this just gets washed out. Okay, this guy never appears in the phase space density. Nevertheless, it's a slowly varying mode, so one can, in principle, ask what is the symplectic structure for these delta A and delta B modes. Well, we have a symplectic form. We can just take these modes and plug it in, and when you do that calculation, what you find is that these A and B modes are exactly coupled together in the symplectic form. Okay. So this delta A is precisely sort of a. I'm not going through the details of why delta A is exactly the same thing as delta U, but I hope it's not too hard for you to convince yourself that this mode here is the grayscale fluctuation. But the key point here is that there is another sort of slowly varying degree of freedom in the microscopic phase space that you can identify, which is sort of canonically conjugate to this grayscale density. And that sort of seems to fit together very nicely with the picture that we had from the gravity point of view, where we had this grayscale fluctuation coming from gravity, and then gravity also, in addition, gave you this soft mode, which was a holonomy from the gravitational perspective. A bit mysterious why it appears in that context, nevertheless. But even on the CFT side, if we are careful to sort of isolate these soft or slowly varying modes in the microscopic phase space, then you indeed find a similar soft or slowly varying mode, in this case, appearing, which is not completely obvious, but needs to be sort of delicately extracted from the phase space of the from the phase space of the microscopic theory. Okay, so that was the basic message that I wanted to convey, which is that there are these soft modes which appear in calculations of the symplectic form in gravity, and at least in these very controlled settings, such as the half BPS sector that we are studying here, it is possible to sort of tease out these slowly varying modes from the phase space, from the microscopic phase space, or the space of microstate deformations in the CFT, and we hope that this discussion will shed some light on discussions of soft modes in at the black hole horizon in gravity. Unfortunately, this particular solution does not have a finite size horizon, so it's kind of hard to extrapolate from this situation. But in future studies, we hope to make some contact with that setup. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Can those be interpretable as some kind of local translation on the LLM surface? I mean, does it sort of look like the mode you're talking about?
That's a great question. I don't know, because the delta lambda and delta lambda tilde modes, this calculation was entirely done around the superstar geometry, where there's no microscopic ring configuration which you're deforming, etc. Right? The deformations here are deformations of the microscopic ring configurations.
If you told me that it was diffeomorphisms in the bulk, which were becoming sort of non-gauge of the singularity, that would smell more like this than it's Maxwell-type gauge translation.
Right.
The two may be related because there's all kinds of things going on. So that's kind of interesting. I was looking for this. Can you recast this as a breaking of difference?
That's a great question. So in this case, we don't know how to do that. However, there are similar black hole geometries, like the D1, D5, the two-charge case in the D1, D5 system, where, again, you have superstar-like geometries. In that context, too, we studied the symplectic form. And in that context, you do find, what you find is that these sort of gauge modes get replaced by pure diff modes. In that context, however, in that case, we don't have a CFT construction of those modes. Coming back to this setup, I don't know whether these holonomies can be related to diffeomorphisms.
Although your picture over there isn't really diffeomorphism in the sense that there's some background metric or maybe variable when you translate the phase space.
Yes. Yes.
So it's more like that.
Yes. However, again, as I said, the gravity calculation sees none of this underlying structure. So the only thing gravity
there is a gravity calculation that does see the underlying structure.
Sure.
You can do the calculation in the pure states that aren't
there. Sure.
You can ignore the fact that those things are actually Planck scale and put it in structure.
Right.
And you can try to understand it as a way in the gravity calculation directly force graining and sort of pure geometry.
That's perfectly. Completely agree. I completely agree. Yeah. So indeed, that would be interesting to study purely from a gravity point of view, how this coarse graining happens. Yeah. I agree.
Okay. So we will be meeting at 6 in the common room in 6th floor of Broad, if anyone wants to come have dinner, but let's turn on Karen.
Thank you.